In every job that must be done, there is an element of fun. You find the fun, and snap, the job's a game. And every task you undertake becomes a piece of cake, a lark, a spree. It's very clear to see that a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down, the medicine go down, medicine go down. Just a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down in a most delightful way.
Welcome, my friends, welcome to another edition of the Corbett Report. I am your host, James Corbett, podcasting to you from the sunny climes of Western Japan on this 27th day of July, 2007. I'd like to welcome all the new listeners to the Corbett Report. I'm pleased to note that the report has been growing by leaps and bounds lately, and we've been gaining new listeners every week. So I'd like to take this opportunity to welcome the new listeners and let them know a little bit about the Corbett Report. The Corbett Report is a weekly news and information podcast based on the principle of open source intelligence gathering. We use open sources such as the internet, radio, television, and other publicly available information to bring you the news and information that is not being reported on in the controlled corporate media. Every statement in every episode of the Corbett Report is backed up by documentation, and you can find the documentation for each episode by going to the Corbett Report website at www.corbettreport.com, CORBETT report.com. And you will be able to find the documentation under the Episodes tab. You'll also be able to find articles written by the Corbett Report under the Articles tab. Please check the website frequently as we're adding new material all the time. That's a very positive note for beginning today's podcast, but unfortunately today I am not the bearer of tidings of comfort and joy. I'm here to tell you a little bit about Big Pharma, the pharmaceutical industry. The pharmaceutical industry by no means gets a good reputation, even in the corporate-controlled media. I think it's the general perception of the public and most people that I talk to that the pharmaceutical industry is a reprehensible display of greed and avarice, benefiting on people's sickness and trying to sell us drugs that we don't need or that may actually harm us. This is a rather popular opinion these days, so this point does not need to be stressed too vigorously. But it is important to note that the pharmaceutical industry is an extremely large industry. It was estimated in 2005 that the big pharma companies drew in over $250 billion. And it was estimated that in 2002, the worldwide pharmaceutical industry was worth over $400 billion. Obviously, we're talking about a staggering amount of money, and this staggering amount of money is then fed back into the PR machine, which keeps the pharmaceutical industry afloat. But even this staggering amount of money cannot defeat the combined might of the general public interfacing on the internet to spread truth about these pharmaceutical companies. I start then from the perspective that most people are aware of the concerns regarding the pharmaceutical industry. I think most people know that these pharmaceutical companies fudge the truth regarding their products in order to make a profit. And we can think of this critique of the pharmaceutical industry as the soft critique, which blames them for inadvertently, or perhaps through omission, lying to the public to increase sales. Harm that is caused by the pharmaceutical company's products in this regard are, of course, regrettable, but perhaps we are in a moral gray area where the pharmaceutical company themselves, although being perhaps not fully forthcoming with the truth, are not necessarily consciously intending to cause harm to their customers. In this regard, I point to a BBC News article from the 10th of June 2007 entitled Fears Over Child Epilepsy Drugs, which goes on to state, quote, "Many medicines are not fully tested on children before licensing, meaning consultants have no official guidance on doses to refer to when prescribing. Instead, they often have to estimate a safe and effective dose based on the age and the size of the child," end quote. Here we have a situation where pharmaceutical companies, because of the difficulties involved in testing in clinical trials on children, because of regulations by governing bodies like the Food and Drug Administration or the FDA in the United States, they aren't able to fully test their drugs on children, and thus it's something of a delicate balancing act for doctors who do not have clear guidelines on effective doses for the children. Of course, there are problems that arise from this, with children being overdosed or underdosed, and serious problems resulting from this, but again, this can't exactly be blamed fully on the conscious intention of the pharmaceutical company to cause harm. Or we have a report also from BBC News, this time from the 1st of February 2007, entitled Anti-AIDS Gel Trial is Stopped, which revealed a rather startling clinical trial which was taking place in Africa under the auspices of the World Health Organization, which is a United Nations-linked agency. And the article reads in part, quote, "Clinical trials of a new drug designed to help prevent women contracting the AIDS virus have been stopped." The World Health Organization said the drug, involving a gel known as a microbicide, did not help the women and made them more vulnerable. The tests were carried out on more than 1,300 women in South Africa, Benin, Uganda, and India. End quote. And the report goes on to state that 30 women had actually contracted HIV since the trial had started. And apparently that indicated that the odds of the women contracting HIV actually went up by using this pharmaceutical, which was developed by a Canadian pharmaceutical company known as Polydex Pharmaceuticals. Again, we have a situation where a clinical trial was started, and it turned out that the drug, in fact, did the exact opposite of what it was intended for. Again, we just have pharmaceutical company incompetence to blame for the drug reaching this clinical trial stage and actually helping to infect some of the people that they were trying to ostensibly help. Or we have this report from CBC News from the 10th of May 2007, entitled Court Finds OxyContin Maker $634 Million U.S. And it goes on to detail the fact that a Virginia court penalized OxyContin manufacturer Purdue Pharma LP a record $634 million for knowingly lying, making false claims about the drug's risk of addiction. Perhaps that should have been Rush Limbaugh's defense. But regardless, this time we have a case where a company outright lied to its customers about the risks of its own drug in order to secure more profit. Again, all of these cases, we have situations where there was not a conscious intention to actually inflict harm on patients. Or if harm was caused, it was just a side effect, excuse the pun, of the pharmaceutical company's actions. However, today I want to get into much, much more serious matters. Today we're going to look at cases where pharmaceutical companies knowingly continue to engage in practices which will cause disease and even death in some of their customers simply in order to produce more profit. This might sound outrageous, but I think one only has to think back to the 1970s and 1980s infections of hepatitis C and HIV, of hemophilia patients in Canada, in the United States, in the UK, in fact in many countries, in which contaminated blood was given to hemophilia patients. And it's starting to emerge that various agencies actually knew that they were giving contaminated blood to hemophilia patients and continued the practice despite knowing the health risks. In this regard, I point to a BBC news story from the 18th of April 2007, entitled Contaminated Blood Inquiry Begins. And this report reads in part, quote, "An independent public inquiry into the supply of contaminated NHS blood to hemophilia patients is set to hear evidence from those infected. During the 1970s and early 1980s, nearly 5,000 people were exposed to hepatitis C, and of those, more than 1,200 were also infected with HIV. More than 1,700 patients have since died, and many more are terminally ill. BBC's Newsnight program has reported seeing documents suggesting experts were aware of the threat at an early stage, but transfusions were not stopped. End quote. Again, that's a case that I think has been widely publicized in the media in all the countries affected by that scandal, regarding a case where agencies that were designed to protect us from the threat of disease were in fact knowingly infecting us with that disease. But this practice is much more prevalent than I think widely assumed. For those of you who saw the recent movie The Constant Gardener and thought it was a Hollywood potboiler based on a novel by a second-rate spy novelist, you might be interested in this report from the Washington Post, republished in The Age online from Australia on May 31st, 2007. The report is entitled "Nigeria Sues Pfizer Over Child Deaths," and seems to almost exactly mirror what happened in that Constant Gardener movie. It actually details the fact that the Nigerian state itself is actually suing Pfizer Pharmaceuticals for more than $2 billion for conducting clinical trials of an unapproved drug within its territorial boundaries. The report reads in part, quote, "Nigerian officials have laid charges against pharmaceutical giant Pfizer for its alleged role in the deaths of children who received an unapproved drug in a meningitis epidemic. Authorities in Kano, Nigeria's biggest state, filed 8 charges this month related to the 1996 clinical trial, including counts of criminal conspiracy and voluntarily causing grievous harm. They filed a civil lawsuit seeking more than $2 billion in damages and restitution from Pfizer. The government alleges that Pfizer researchers chose 200 children from crowds at a makeshift epidemic camp in Kano and gave about half the untested antibiotic Trovan. Researchers gave the other children what the lawsuit described as a dangerously low dose of a comparison drug made by Hoffman LaRoche. Officials said Pfizer's actions resulted in the deaths of several children and left others deaf, paralyzed, blind, or brain damaged." End quote. Here we have the case of a pharmaceutical company blinded by greed and avarice, seeking to evade strict rules and regulations on clinical trials in developed countries, turning to the third world in order to test out new and dangerous unapproved medicines, a practice which is apparently becoming more and more common in this day and age. Perhaps even more disturbing, we have this report from Scarborough Country, an MSNBC program which last year detailed stunning allegations coming out recently about Bayer Corporation and their role in supplying drugs to hemophiliacs in Spain, France, and Japan in the 1980s, which knowingly infected them with the HIV virus. Let's turn to a clip from the Scarborough Country program detailing this unthinkable homicide wittingly perpetrated by executives at the Bayer Corporation.
Mike, welcome to the show. We appreciate you being on tonight.
Thanks for the invitation, Joe.
Okay, let's talk about the rat of the week. Why is Bayer Corporation the rat of the week?
Internal documents show that after this company positively, absolutely knew that they had a medication that was infected with the AIDS virus, they took the product off the market in the U.S. and then they dumped it in France, Europe, Asia, and Latin America. The medicine's called Factor VIII. It was an injection medicine that was used for hemophiliacs, mostly children. Children had been born with an incurable
disease. Hold on, Mike. So you're telling me that Bayer knew that this drug was infected with the AIDS virus. They yanked it from the market in America, and then they dumped it in markets overseas?
They had to figure out a way, Joe, to make a profit on a product that they could not sell in America. So they made a huge profit. They dropped the product in Japan, Spain, and France. By the way, Joe, government officials in France that allowed that to happen actually had to go to prison for it. In America, not one corporate executive for this company has been indicted or even criminally investigated by our Justice Department.
Why not? What, you're telling me that these people that dumped this AIDS-tainted blood in foreign countries,
yes,
who killed children, have not been taken to task in the United States?
It's worse than that. The U.S. government allowed it to happen. The FDA allowed this to happen. And now the government is completely looking the other way. Thousands of innocent hemophiliacs have died from the AIDS virus. And not only they're dying, their family members are dying because they're becoming infected with the disease. This company knew absolutely that they had a problem with the product. They knew that it was infected with AIDS. They dumped it because they wanted wanted to turn this disaster into a profit.
Mike, I want to read to you what Bayer told the New York Times about this scandal. They said Bayer behaved responsibly, ethically, and humanely. Decisions made nearly two decades ago were based on the best scientific information of the time and were consistent with the regulations in place. That sounds like a lot of legal mumbo jumbo. Now, you say you have internal documents that show that they knew that this drug they were dumping was tainted with the AIDS drug?
The
AIDS virus?
The documents show that there was no question that this company absolutely understood the risk, that they knew that it was contaminated. It wasn't a possibility. They knew it was contaminated. Americans were dying from the product before it was pulled off the market. The only reason it was pulled off the market is because lawyers found the documents and showed it to the government, and finally the government said, you can't sell it here, but then the government allowed them to dump it in Spain, France, and Japan.
That's just amazing.
Well, I want
to read to you what the New York Times said, and this is an investigation that they also did, and they said the federal government was part of the problem. While the Food and Drug Administration told the company not to ship the drugs overseas, the man responsible for the drug supply, quote, ask that the issue be quietly solved without alerting the Congress, the medical community, and the public. This is a cover-up, and our Congress is not doing anything. What should Americans do?
That's a good question. And in answer to that question, the answer is apparently nothing. No major follow-up to that story, and the story was in fact buried, and not much more has come out of it. Yes, indeed, still to this day, no member of Bayer's executive has been charged in that case, despite the undoubted acts of homicide committed in the case. Another and even more disturbing, if that were possible, case of pharmaceutical companies knowingly inflicting harm on the public derives from the area of vaccine research. Vaccines, of course, stand as the untarnished, unblemished symbol of the pinnacle of human technology in the fight against disease, and probably the poster boy for modern medicine. Vaccines, as the proponents of modern medicine would have us believe, are responsible for so much unmitigated good that it would hardly be beneficial to question their wonderful prophylactic and therapeutic effects. However, it is just that I would like to engage in. Let's start by taking a look at the sanitized, if you'll excuse the pun, version of vaccine history propounded by most medical sources. Vaccines, as we can read about on Wikipedia, are, quote, an antigenic preparation used to establish immunity to a disease. The term derives from Edward Jenner's use of cowpox. Vacca means cow in Latin, which, when administered to humans, provided them protection against smallpox, which Louis Pasteur and others perpetuated. Jenner realized that milkmaids who had contact with cowpox did not get smallpox. The process of distributing and administering vaccines is referred to as vaccination. End quote. And, of course, we can go on to read about the different types of vaccines. Vaccines containing killed microorganisms, vaccines containing live attenuated microorganisms, toxoids, and subunits. We can learn about how vaccines have helped us develop immunity to smallpox and chickenpox and polio and mumps and rubella, measles, and other deadly diseases, and how they have only been responsible for good and have been effective in treating all of these diseases. I'm here today to let you know that is not true. The subject, of course, is so vast that I could not possibly do it justice in one podcast, and I hope to spend more time in a future podcast episode detailing some of the problems with vaccines. But again, we can point to the same kinds of problems that were noted earlier in the soft critique of the pharmaceutical companies, in which pharmaceutical companies attempt to grab a greater slice of the share of the medical industry results in drugs of questionable integrity or questionable utility. An example of this comes from a Canadian press report from May 14, 2007, entitled "Amid Bird Flu Vaccine Debate, Scientists Aren't Sure of Protective Dose." And that report reads in part, quote, "Concerns about the developing world's access to affordable pandemic vaccines took center stage Monday at the World Health Organization's annual general meeting, the World Health Assembly. But as global health leaders struggle to ensure pandemic vaccines won't just be a tool for wealthy countries, influenza scientists admit they face an enormous conundrum, one that could stand in the way of efforts to transform vaccines for the few into vaccines for the many. Simply put, scientists can't be certain how much vaccine is needed to protect people against novel influenza viruses, such as H5N1 avian flu, because they don't know what the immune system of a person protected against a new flu strain would look like. Sure, they can observe whether immunization with H5N1 vaccine produces certain antibodies, and to what level the antibodies rise, but they have no way of gauging how much protection those antibodies will provide if the person is exposed to the virus. We can't get the answer to that until the pandemic comes. There's just no way, admits Dr. Robert Webster, the renowned flu researcher from St. Jude Children's Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee. The uncertainty about what protection against H5N1 actually looks like is bedeviling ongoing debates over whether people should be pre-vaccinated against the virus or whether a program of ultra-low or single-dose vaccines could be safely used to stretch limited supplies and protect millions more people. End quote. Well, I would be willing to wager a guess as to which side of the pre-vaccination debate the pharmaceutical companies fall upon. And I can imagine the PR campaign that we're going to be treated to in the coming years as this becomes more of an issue. But again, that's a soft critique of the pharmaceutical companies in which, in the pursuit of a little bit more profits, they pump drugs into us that may not be necessary. But again, we have more evidence coming out from the vaccine debate about pharmaceutical companies knowingly inflicting harm on their customers in the pursuit of profit. We turn to the MMR debate. The MMR is the mumps, measles, and rubella vaccine, which is used in many industrialized nations to protect children against those diseases. The MMR vaccine is a mixture of live attenuated viruses, and it's administered via injection for immunization against measles, mumps, and rubella. It's generally issued around the age of 1 year, with a booster shot before children start school around age 4 or 5. However, there has been much controversy recently since at least 1998, when a Dr. Andrew Wakefield published a report suggesting a link between bowel disease, autism, and the MMR injection. Dr. Wakefield's report has been the subject of steady and heated critique among scientists since its issue in 1998, and whatever one makes of Dr. Wakefield's work, it's instructive to note the vehemence of the critiques which he has been subjected to since the release of that report. But we have this report from the Daily Mail from the 11th of July 2007 entitled, "Who is Telling the Truth About MMR Jabs and Autism?" The report details the struggle of one Jackie Fletcher, whose son Robert developed autism after being given the MMR jab as a toddler. And the report reads in part, quote, "Now a recent study has shown that as many as 1 in 58 children in Britain may have some form of autism, a far higher number than was previously thought to have been affected. Two of the 7 academics at Cambridge University who were involved with the research believe this may be linked to the MMR vaccine." End quote. And while controversy continues to swirl around the MMR vaccine and its possible neurotoxic effects, that doesn't stop the World Health Organization from inflicting even more damage on Iraqi children. This report from BBC News, 20th of April 2007, entitled "Millions in Iraq to Get MMR Jab." And it reads in part, quote, "A major immunization campaign is to take place in Iraq in a bid to prevent an outbreak of measles. The World Health Organization and UNICEF are overseeing the work of 8,000 volunteers who aim to give up to 3.9 million children the MMR vaccine. The children aged 1 to 5 have missed out on their routine jabs because of the instability in Iraq. Health experts warn measles could kill up to 10% of infected children if an epidemic took hold." Again, of course, this sounds brilliant, and who could possibly deny that it's a wonderful humanitarian effort to try to get this MMR vaccine to these underprivileged children in Iraq. But there are still serious questions about the health risks involved with these types of vaccines. Another possible clue to the health risks of vaccination come from this report from Nexus Magazine, an Australian online magazine that you can find at nexusmagazine.com, which issued a report in 1998 by Vera Scheibner, PhD, called "Shaken Baby Syndrome, the Vaccination Link." And the subtitle is, "Many infants who suffer the so-called shaken baby syndrome may be victims of undiagnosed vaccine damage." The report reads in part, quote, "Recently there has been quite an epidemic of the so-called shaken baby syndrome. parents, usually the fathers or other caregivers such as nannies, have increasingly been accused of shaking a baby to the point of causing permanent brain damage and death. Why? Is there an unprecedented increase in the number of people who commit infanticide or have an ambition to seriously hurt babies? Or is there something more sinister at play? Some time ago, I started getting requests from lawyers or the accused parents themselves for expert reports. A close study of the history of these cases revealed something distinctly sinister. In every single case, the symptoms appeared shortly after the baby's vaccinations. While investigating the personal medical history of these babies based on the caregivers' diaries and medical records, I quickly established that these babies were given one or more of the series of so-called routine shots, hepatitis B, DPT, diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus, polio, and HIB, hemophilus influenzae type B, shortly before they developed systems of illness resulting in serious brain damage or death. The usual scenario is that a baby is born and does well initially. At the usual age of about 2 months, it is administered the first series of vaccines as above. Sometimes a hepatitis B injection is given shortly after birth while the mother and child are still in hospital. However, a great number of babies now die within days or within 2 to 4 weeks of birth after hepatitis B vaccination, as documented by the record of the VAERS, Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System in the USA. So the baby stops progressing, starts deteriorating, and usually develops signs of respiratory tract infection. Then comes the second and third injections, and tragedy strikes. The child may cry intensely and inconsolably, may stop feeding properly, vomit, have difficulty swallowing, become irritable, stop sleeping, and may develop convulsions with accelerating progressive deterioration of its condition and mainly its brain function. This, of course, feeds into another category of dubious medical value, the sudden infant death syndrome, which Dr. Scheibner talks about also in that article. But it's in this spirit that we move on to news that has developed in the last several months involving a new Merck vaccine known as Gardasil. We have this report from the ChronicleHerald.ca, a Halifax, Nova Scotia-based newspaper, by John Gillis from June 21st, 2007, headlined Girls to Get HPV Vaccine. Quote, Nova Scotia will offer girls in grade 7 vaccination this fall against human papillomavirus, the leading cause of cervical cancer. Health Promotion and Protection Minister Barry Barnett announced the $2.8 million campaign Wednesday at a Halifax news conference. The cost of the campaign will be covered under a fund established in the federal budget. The vaccine has been shown to provide almost 100% protection against the two strains of human papillomavirus, HPV, known to cause about 70% of cervical cancers, said Dr. Robert Grimshaw, medical director of Cancer Care Nova Scotia's gynecological cancer screening program. With the introduction of HPV vaccine, along with regular pap testing, it's possible that during the lifespan of my career, cervical cancer will become a disease of the past, he said. Nova Scotia has the highest incidence of cervical cancer in Canada. About 55 women in the province are diagnosed with cervical cancer each year, and about 20 die of the disease. There are about 200 types of human papillomavirus. Most people come in contact with it by adulthood. End quote. And of course, what that article does not tell you is that the Gardasil vaccine in question only protects against two possible strains of this HPV virus, of which there are over 200 strains in existence, 30 of which are known to cause cancer. To get some more information about this and other vaccine risks, I phoned Ms. Etta West. Etta West is a researcher and anti-vaccination advocate with the Vaccine Risk Awareness Network, a group whose mission is to provide information about possible vaccine effects and adverse reactions to the general public. You can find their website at www.vran.org, vran.org, and you can find the complete interview I did with Miss Etta West on my website, thecorbettreport.com, CORBETT report.com. Miss West joined me in BC to talk about various vaccines and their risks, and we talked a little bit about the Gardasil vaccine, which is being introduced in Canada. And finally, just one question before I go, but do you have any comments on the new Merck vaccine known as Gardasil, which is being introduced into Canada as we speak?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's been a huge, huge hype that has gone on with the Gardasil vaccine. And it was very dismaying to see the Canadian federal government allocate $300 million to launch this vaccine in Canada. And that's only one-third of what it's going to cost to have this vaccine distributed and implemented in the various provinces. And it's falsely advertised as a cancer vaccine. I have some interesting articles. There's a recent article actually in the journal, Cancer Monthly. And, you know, it talks about, how, you know, they've looked at the research with the human papillomavirus. And what they have found is actually that the most tenacious and the most severe tumors don't have that virus attached to it or influencing it. And, you know, there are so many questions. And then starting, you know, they want to vaccinate, you know, young prepubescent girls with this vaccine. The vaccine has never been tested for carcinogenicity. So in other words, they have no idea if the vaccine itself can cause cancer. There are over 100 sero groups of HPV, human papillomavirus. So they've only targeted two that have been found, associated with certain precancerous cells. But in the majority of women, something like 90% of women, those cells clear on their own without any interference whatsoever. So, you know, a lot of people have expressed that concern. This vaccine has not been tested for itself being able to cause cancer. And it's another vaccine added to the already crowded lineup. And we have an excellent page on it on our website, so if anybody wants to read more and really read the strong, very valid criticisms of it, they can just find it on our website and read that page and go to some of the excellent links that we offer as well. But there's a lot of criticism. It's Merck's next big scam after Vioxx. You know, it's unfortunate. It's absolutely tragic that the Canadian government is just yet again buying into another vaccine scam. you know, and especially as many Canadian people who are involved in women's health have said, if they took that money and put it into making, pap smears available, to many more women who right now don't have access, then right there they would reduce the cancer rates, because they know that the most effective way to reduce the cancer is to detect it through the pap smears and for women then to get treatment. So it's very tragic. It's horrible for somebody like myself who's been watching this field for so many years.
Yes, some sobering information, but thank you for bringing it to us to our attention today. Thank you very much for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
Indeed, I suggest you check out the information that Etta West provided in that interview by going to vran.org to find out more information about the Gardasil vaccine, and also looking up that Cancer Monthly article which Ms. West mentioned in the interview. The article is extremely important in that it does note that the Gardasil vaccine, although being touted as a way of preventing cervical cancer as a result of HPV, was in fact not approved by the FDA on that basis, but on the basis that it prevented precancerous lesions, which is evidently not the same thing. More evidence of risk with this vaccine is found with a report that judicialwatch.org obtained of the VAERS line list report. We remember the VAERS as the vaccine adverse effect reporting system in the United States, which the FDA uses to keep track of various adverse effects of vaccines. And as of the 11th of May 2007, several months ago now, there had been over 1,637 reports of adverse reactions to this brand new vaccine, including 3 deaths and 136 serious non-fatal adverse reactions. Those are some disturbing statistics indeed, but perhaps more disturbing is the fact that such statistics will never be compiled in Canada, or at least not any time in the foreseeable future. As Ms. West noted elsewhere in my interview with her, Canada does not have an equivalent to the VAERS system that the FDA uses to keep track of adverse reactions to vaccines. Quite simply put, Canada does not have a way of tracking these vaccine adverse reactions. Of course, I'm sure that the safety of this vaccine is completely assured by the fact that it's been approved by the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration in the United States, who, as we remember, allowed Bayer Corporation to dump their HIV-infected Factor VIII on France, Spain, and Japan, knowingly killing hemophiliacs, mostly children, in those countries. It's also, of course, been approved by Health Canada, which is comforting to note because, as we remember from last week's episode, Canada's governmental bureaucracy has already started lowering health standards in Canada by, for example, raising the amount of maximum residue limits that are allowed as pesticides on food crops, because otherwise it would, of course, be a trade irritant in our ever-growing North American Union with the United States, our biggest trading partner. So, if you believe that government agencies will keep you safe and that you don't have to worry about things like adverse reactions to vaccines which are going to cause deaths of small children in Canada, well, then I guess you should enjoy your vaccines and make sure to take them as whenever your doctor recommends. If, however, you are concerned by this information and want to know more, I suggest you get outside the control of the controlled corporate media and research some of this information for yourself. Go to sites like VRAN.org to find out more about vaccines and their possible adverse side effects. Or look for alternative health news sites on the internet. For political news, go to sites like Infowars.com, PrisonPlanet.com, JonesReport.com, and Infowars.net to find out what's really happening in this world. Big Pharma indeed does love you to death. That's it for this week. I am your host, James Corbett. Thank you for joining me for this week's episode of The Corbett Report. Stay tuned for next week's episode. The police state's noose is coiling around your neck.
I've got the mighty, let me tell the news. My head got wet in midnight dew. Great God, I've been down on my bended knees, talking to a man from Galilee. My God spoke and he sounds so sweet. I thought I heard the shuffle of angels' feet. He put one hand upon my head. Great God, the mighty, let me tell you.